Hello, this is Bill Bupert, and I'm the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. The Libertarian Institute is kind enough to host one of the hosting venues for my Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast, which is a fortnightly production that comes out. And also, I blog quite frequently there on military travails, failures, frauds, and just the overall cascade of calamities and chaos avalanche that is U.S. and Western military affairs today. Sometimes I'll reflect on others, but for the most part, that's where I spend most of my time, detailing the existential crisis that the U.S. and Western military complex find themselves in the 21st century, reflecting back a lot historically, of course, on what's happened before, because you can't possibly know where you are unless you know where you've been. So in this case, this may be the first of a host of occasional flash messages that I'll send out, short audio podcasts on something that has either crossed my mind or the Institute has requested I comment on. In this case, the Institute reached out to me and they said, "Hey, Bill, on the Ben Shapiro show about a month ago, there was an episode entitled, Who Was the Bad Guy in World War II? And Neil Ferguson was a guest on there, an eminent historian. And I was asked to listen to the 42 minutes and give my assessment of what was said and what was claimed. And I have to tell you as a preamble, that whole thing was a result of the Tucker Carlson and Daryl Cooper Martyr Made podcast interview that occurred that caused so many ripples throughout all of the political spheres and caused a lot of the, especially I would say, conservative and right of center commentators to leap on their fainting couches and grab whatever it was that would calm their nerves after some of the claims that Daryl Cooper made. Now, my personal reflection on what Daryl Cooper claimed and such was in episode 52 entitled CG Excursion, that would be Chasing Ghost Excursion, Churchill, Imperial Bombast, and the Death of the West. Because one of the things that really stuck out and caused a splinter or a mote in the eye of the conservative and received wisdom historians planet-wide is that, and I think that he was being a bit bombastic and maybe even hyperbolic when Daryl said this, because I love his podcast, I love his approach to history, and I really pay attention to what he says because I think he's very well informed. And in this particular case, what happened is that he made this claim, and like I said, this may have been hyperbolic, where he said the chief villain of World War II, which I often characterize as the war to save Joseph Stalin because of what happened as a result of the Western victory in World War II in 1945, the chief villain. Now, everybody dogpiled on that particular comment. So I think it was a grammatical error more so than an historical error, but this is what most of the received wisdom champions have glommed onto to make the claim that you can't listen to anything that Daryl Cooper says, because he said that Churchill was the chief villain instead of saying he was a chief villain. So I address Churchill extensively in episode 52, and I think you'll enjoy that if you want to get a really thorough background on what made Churchill, I am a reluctant Anglophile, what made Churchill so monstrous and such, to a large extent, a war fellow his entire adult life. So I want to address a couple things as a preamble. I am an amateur historian. I do not have a graduate degree in history. I have taught at university before. I've lectured at universities before. But nonetheless, what I find are the three things that make me a sober historian is number one, and this is rather contemporaneous, but I think that all of us have been exposed to this for so long in the last 10 years, we're rather tired of it, and that's that the woketopians think it is all about power. And by the way, they're right. But they think the right authoritarian psychopaths in power will bring utopia, and I know, that all political power leads to evil deeds, inevitably. Number two, good history is interpreted and written by those who know altruism is always a lie. You'd be surprised if you took that one little cognitive reflection and applied it to your historical reading, what would happen. And of course, there's Buber's corollary to Acton's axiom, which is that power attracts the corruptible and absolute power attracts even worse. So with those notions in mind, that is how I approach history. And I think that I wouldn't say that I'm dispassionate, because when it comes to bias filters and our readings of history and our readings of every day and the cultural analysis that we take part in, either consciously or unconsciously all the time, what you discover is that if you instantiate what your bias filter is, and you are able to have a pretty good estimate of what the bias filter is of who you're reading, whether it is Neil Ferguson or whether it is Howard Zinn or everybody in between, what you will discover is that you can start to read between the lines. And you can especially do this if you take Adler's approach to reading and such, where he calls it a syntopicon. He calls it syntopical reading, which is reading a minimum of 3 to 5 books on the same subject by different authors. And all of a sudden, if you're a very engaged, involved, and interrogative reader, especially one who pays attention to footnotes, maybe you've got the time to follow where those breadcrumbs lead, you can all of a sudden come to conclusions about things that would rival that of history professors that you may have suffered under in your high school or university years. And there is also this conceit in the national and international professional historian community, like the American Historical Association or Hysterical Association, however you want to characterize it, and like everything in the universities, especially in the soft sciences, the social sciences, the non-sciences, as it were, they are just absolutely saturated in race, class, and gender, all blended together in a Marxian lens. Eric Foner, for instance, F-O-N-E-R, who was head of the association for a while, and others, you would be hard-pressed where you could toss a cat around at an American Historical Association meeting, and you will hit the head of some comrade who's standing around, whether he's a Marxist, a Maoist, a Marxist-Leninist, or whatever flavor of government supremacist you can come up with. Now, surprisingly enough, there are a few right-of-center historians out there who tackle these subjects who are received in broader audiences. Dan Carlin comes to mind, even though I think he's very centrist. And one thing about Dan Carlin, I love his history, but he has a tendency, unfortunately, to ask the right questions and always veer into the wrong answers. The guy I can recommend number one all the time to tell you from a liberty perspective or libertarian perspective or an anarchist perspective in the anarcho-capitalist sensibility, who is always going to show you the way as far as what actually happened in history in the past, is none other than C.J. Kilmer of Prof. C.J.'s Dangerous History, who is also a fellow at the Libertarian Institute. And I highly recommend listening to his stuff, because the guy knows what he's about and he knows what he's talking about. Neil Ferguson, the eminento and historian, who is slightly right of center, maybe someone would characterize him as that, on the Ben Shapiro program that I talked about, and we'll, in the show notes for this particular episode, we'll have the link so that you can listen to the episode that I'm critiquing, which was approximately 42 minutes long. What happens that is very curious here is that all of a sudden there's a lot of gatekeeping hysteria going on, because how can one be an historian unless you're a member of the American Historical Association, unless you have graduate degrees in history, unless you are trained in being an archivist or an historiographer? I mean, I remember at one point, and I'm paraphrasing, when the whole kerfuffle over Daryl Cooper's appearance on the Tucker Carlson show happened, all of a sudden what we discover is that if you're not school trained, you can't possibly be an historian. And I'm here to tell you that when it comes to primary and secondary source documentation, you must read. You must examine evidence. You must, syntopically, thank you, Mortimer Adler, have a sensibility of, well, what went on then? And what you must do is you must dispose of any sense of presentism that you have. And here's what presentism is. Presentism is that notion that here I am in the 21st century, I'm so progressive, or I'm so wise in the ways of the world, and when I transport myself via the historical time machine back to the 19th century, the Roman era, it could be 2000 BC, whatever the case may be, all of a sudden I take the mindset that I have now and automatically take it back then, and everybody thought that way. We all know that that's wrong. So let's get to Neil Ferguson's appearance on this Ben Shapiro podcast entitled, Who Was the Bad Guy in World War II? Now, what was really interesting in watching this presentation, I have the highest respect for Neil Ferguson. He's a guy far smarter than me, has published many more books than I have, and he's such an able writer, such an able communicator. But in this case, I think he misses the mark. What they spend almost the entire 40 minutes discussing is that not only has Darryl Cooper broke down the gates to a certain extent, but when he comes in, he's not leaving the right odor and he's not saying the right things and he's questioning some of these things that are so important to the narrative of 20th century Western civilization. And one of those notions is that the greatest generation and the Western nations fighting fascism, not fighting communism because they allied themselves with the Soviet Union, but fighting fascism and national socialism and such. And of course, remember that from my position of observance, government supremacism is the overarching rubric under which one can describe communism, national socialism, socialism, Marxist-Leninism, you name it. It is all the emphasis of the collective over the individual at all cost. What was, I wouldn't say it was rather alarming, but I was surprised to see Ferguson sort of stooping to this position. They really glommed onto the fact that he said that Churchill was the chief villain. I don't agree that Churchill was the chief villain. And I just explained a few moments ago why I think Darryl Cooper either had a slip of the tongue or was being hyperbolic. Whatever the case may be, he wasn't the chief villain. He was one of all the chief villains there. And of course, I talk about that in episode 52 at length. But what we find here is that they're going, well, also, not only did he say that Churchill, who happens to be almost an icon to members of the right in Western civilization, I mean all over the West, that tends to be the case where they hold him in the highest odor, but that all of a sudden, Darryl Cooper somehow, some way, is a Nazi apologist. Now, there were some things that Cooper said that I thought didn't quite fit the narrative of German behavior. By the way, isn't it curious the way we say, well, they fought the Nazis? Why do we not say, well, but the Marxist-Leninists in Russia fought the Nazis, or the Democrat Party and the Tory Party fought the Nazis? Why is Germany pulled out? I mean, they don't even do this for the Japanese contestants in World War II, where the political affiliation of the party is what was fighting and not the German army or whatever may be the case. I always found that curious. But in this case, I think what they're trying to do desperately, and you could smell some of the desperation in this interview, is that for the longest time, it has been the received narrative, the received history, that whenever it comes to Winston Churchill, FDR, all the Western leaders, to include, by the way, Joseph Stalin, that they must be characterized in a neutral or beneficial fashion to how they look in history to be beneficial to the creation of the post-World War II civilization that emerged from that time once the Germans and the Japanese were defeated. I would suggest to everybody here that there is an historian cartel that Prof. C.J., myself in a much more diminished fashion, and others have tried to break through, have tried to break apart, have tried to establish that, for the most part, one doesn't have to have the academic credentials and the graduate degrees to be an able historian. I know of dozens of historians who I've read who don't happen to be professional historians, but do wonderful work. And I'm also afraid that those historians, especially those historians who are steeped in the ivory tower, in the academy here in the West, and especially in America, which is the one that I'm most familiar with, those are the ones who tend to have the most ideological blinders on. I mentioned the American Historical Association is just chock full of Marxian historians. Marxian historians are not only economically illiterate for the most part, but absolutely obsessed with race, class, and gender and presentism as the sole means by which one can interpret the past to inform the future or to inform the present day. I think all of this is wrong, and I was quite gobsmacked to listen to Neil Ferguson because it seems to me that he and Shapiro were really concerned that if people were starting to topple Churchill off of this statuary he has been atop for the longest time, well, who would be next? Who would be the next victims in the narrative? Would FDR come under scrutiny and examination? There's a whole cottage industry out there, of course, that examines both FDR and Abraham Lincoln and Woodrow Wilson, thank you, Prof. CJ, from a very negative perspective and through a lens that is quite critical, quite skeptical of anything good any of those people did. And I'm on board with that because I think cross-examination is the engine of truth. And I think that what we have to do is we have to pay attention to the fact that until we vigorously re-examine all of the assumptions that we make on a consistent basis, especially as more and more evidence comes in, maybe your wisdom as an individual in observing these things starts to give you new insights or brain zephyrs into just what's going on, it's simply going to make history better. But the history cartel that I just mentioned is comprised of historians like Neil Ferguson, who you could see with his body language and his facial expressions, oh my, it appears that Darrell Cooper doesn't have quite the pedigree that we do with all the credentialed initials behind our names and all of the received wisdom and applause that occurs as a result of us holding forth on all of these things. It's just poppycock, and it's just so much garbage. And what you discover in watching these things is that there is a serious deficit in expanding the received wisdom and asking oneself, well, was World War II and its conclusion, did it advance liberty or did it retard liberty? Did it make communist domination of the world cemented in a fashion it wouldn't have been absent the historical and vast subsidy of Soviet forces against the Germans in World War II? And of course, after the Germans had surrendered in May, all of a sudden, all those Soviet forces that had been fighting on the Eastern Front against the Germans and were victorious, they find after the A-bombs are dropped in August of 1945, they best and annihilate Japanese forces that are arrayed near Siberia, Manchuria, and such, because there had been this curious axis interregnum between the Japanese and the Germans, where the Japanese sort of maintained it was an official and accredited non-aggression pact between themselves and the Russians. But once the Germans assumed room temperature as a fighting force and as a fighting concern, all of a sudden the Russians said, well, all bets are off, all gloves are off, we are heading east. Ferguson says curious things, and he accuses Darrell Cooper of rehashing German propaganda. So I guess what it is that if you're looking at primary source documentation of actual speeches and papers and things like that of the National Socialist Party or the German Wehrmacht or the SS, that if you quote those, what you're doing is you're rehashing German propaganda. But when you're looking at primary source documentation for the West, whether it would be from the UK or the US, that would not be propaganda. That would be proper historical investigation. I think that that's a bunch of garbage. He also talks about, well, what about the bombings and the Battle of Britain and the fact that German bombers started the Battle of Britain? Isn't it interesting that when I examine the record, because the Battle of Britain started in May of 1940, it turns out that the British were bombing, allegedly, military targets in Germany, but we know better, commencing with Luftwaffe seaplane air bases in Hornum on 19 and 20 March 1940. So it appears that the German bombing campaigns were presaged and preluded by British bombing campaigns over Germany proper. Ferguson made no mention of this. Ferguson mentioned Poland very briefly, and what's really interesting about Poland is that when the Germans invaded Poland September 1st, 1939, what happened a mere week beforehand? That would be the non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union signed a mere week before the Germans invaded Poland. And we know that in the middle of Poland, guess who met them? The Russian army did, of course. So in this case, and by the way, I'm not going to make the faux pas of saying that Churchill was in office, but he was having influence. He doesn't go into office as prime minister until May 1940. This is September 1939. And of course, Poland is the sine qua non and the raison d'etre of why the whole thing gets all of these associated allied nations, to include the UK, to declare war on Germany. And by the way, if we fast forward to the end of the war, where does Poland find itself when it was the original sine qua non of why World War II kicked off in the first place in Europe? Well, within the Soviet sphere, as a member of the Warsaw Pact, as a captive nation. And of course, Ferguson goes on to note that isolationism, which he says with a sneer, must be a four-letter word, and that for the most part, if it weren't for U.S. isolationism, things could have moved along faster, but they didn't. Now, Hitler's assignations are taken as gospel, but Churchill's are not, because according to Ferguson, it was the Germans and the Japanese and such who were making all the border incursions and such. And notice he doesn't mention the Soviets in this when it came to that. Of course, what we have is that a week before September 1st, 1939, the Soviets and the Germans emerge and they say, yep, we're going to get in a non-aggression pact between ourselves, because that doesn't stop them from meeting in Poland. Doesn't stop in 1940 from the Russians taking parts of Finland, or should I say attempting to take parts of Finland. And of course, the Germans in 1940 being wildly successful to include an epic six-week strategic takedown of France, followed by other countries which weren't neutral, like Portugal or Spain, that fell like dominoes across the board in the West. Here's what I find curious. Is that Ben Shapiro, whose brain has been bent by his unanointed and unapologetic alliance with Israel, Ferguson, pretty much the same, is that they don't instantiate that Churchill could have been villainous in the least, that he didn't make mistakes, that he didn't do things that were absolutely inhuman and abominable, to include things that I explicated in my episode 52 on Churchill, where I talked about everything from Churchill's willingness to starve the Bengalis in India for the benefit of the European fight, to Operation Keelhaul, where millions of Soviet prisoners, men, women, and children alike, were forced repatriated back to Joseph Stalin's Russia. Now, the reason why that would be so horrific for them, and the reason why at the conclusion of that episode, I read those heart-wrenching excerpts of what folks did to stop themselves from being repatriated to the USSR, was that When it came to Joseph Stalin's assignations of prisoners of war, any of the Red Army who surrendered and lived and surrendered to the enemy, he considered them not as non-combatants, but as traitors to the USSR, which, you know, in a communist system, how could you be surprised? I mean, it is such an anti-human creed in everything that it does. And when it came to warfare from 1941, the summer of 1941, is when Germany, with 150 divisions, raged into the USSR to take it down, didn't succeed. I am of the mindset, thank you, David Stahel, and I urge you all to read his books if you get a chance. He has such a fresh and informed analysis on the Eastern Front campaigns, is that Germany basically died in the summer of 1941, zombified, and it took that zombie almost 4 years to perish in May 1945, when the Russians and the West finally arrived in Germany proper to take them down and see Hitler take his life. Now, remember when I mentioned this very strange notion of presentism, where you take your values and philosophical wisdom that you have today and you project that backwards and assume that everybody was as enlightened, informed, and historically literate as you are, which is nonsensical, even when you project back the 80 years to the war to save Joseph Stalin, World War II. What you discover is that that will cause you not to have the single most accurate picture of just what happened at the time. For instance, I'll take you back a little further into the 19th century, and what you discover is that until William Wilberforce, blessed be his name, stood in the House of Parliament and told both sides that they were both wrong and that the ownership of other human beings was wrong, and he was a laughingstock for years as a result of his Christian intemperance in wanting to embrace slavery, despite at the time, that up until that point, at the beginning of the 19th century, human slavery, East and West, regardless of the religion, for the most part, humanity had been doing that since the beginning of sophisticated civilization, thousands of years before the birth of Christ, and then on to that time. And all of a sudden, this singular man, this one unassuming man, William Wilberforce, with the power of his conviction, managed somehow to convince Great Britain, and they would do this decades later, to actually employ military power, primarily the Royal Navy, to stop, intercept, and waylay the Atlantic slave trade, and others to a lesser scale in the Indian Ocean and such. The reason I bring this up is that what I'm saying is that William Wilberforce had a mind something like today, where he thought that, like I do, like Prof. CJ does, and a number of others at the Institute, that the ownership of other human beings through chattel slavery, regulatory slavery, tax slavery, or whatever the case may be, is morally repugnant. He knew that then. So I could say, as the guy that I am philosophically, and of course there may be some projection in this, that William Wilberforce, to a certain extent, had almost stepped out of a time machine from my time here and somehow, miraculously, was able to look around at the turn of the 19th century and say, you know what? The ownership of human beings is morally repugnant, philosophically unsustainable, and despite, in the West, Christian biblical imprimaturs, which would, of course, resonate throughout the 19th century in America, leading to the Second Civil War from 1860 to 65. The First Civil War, of course, being the divorce from London from 1775 to 1783. And what you discover is that, sure, that presentism may have worked, but nonetheless, one has to know that Wilberforce was a creature of his time. There is a lot of noise and almost nostalgic reflection on the right when it comes to the Roman Empire and how the Roman Empire behaved and what strong armies look like and those kind of things. But what we must remember first and foremost was that the engine of the Roman military, of Rome as a superpower, was that it was a slavery superpower. But by the way, every country on earth was a slavery superpower. The point that I'm making here is that you can sit on your high horse here in the 21st century, as I am suggesting both Ferguson and Shapiro do on their program, and think that we are so wise, that we know that Churchill meant well. Well, he may have meant well. Don't all dictators mean well? But he didn't accomplish what he sought to do. Here you had a man whose entire adult life was dedicated to war, to imperialism, and to colonial power. Here we go again. I'm riffing off of Churchill, but Churchill was the centerpiece of that particular broadcast between Shapiro and Ferguson, and they singing his praises. Again, I refer to you to the previous episode that I did on Churchill, so I won't bore you with it here. But of course, there's a whole host of horrific things that were done during that conflict by the West, whether civilian, military, whatever the case may be. But the flaw that I saw in the interview with Ferguson by Shapiro that was the most egregious was that they were trying to say, well, you know, it was bad. I'm paraphrasing here. It was bad, but the West was the right side. The West was doing the right things. The West was making sure that despite their alliance with the United Soviet Socialist Republic and Stalin, one of the biggest butchers in modern history, nonetheless, they beat the Germans and they beat the Nazis. And for that, the world is a better place. Well, to me, isolationism, I prefer the notion of non-interventionism, is not a four-letter word. Minding your own business is not a bad thing for one to do in either your private life or your national life. I always refer people to Chesterton's fence. Chesterton's fence, and I'm paraphrasing here, is the notion that G.K. Chesterton was the one who made this eminently quotable thing, is it is the idea that if you have a fence and you take that fence down, make sure that you investigate and discover why that fence was put there in the first place. And in so many ways and in so many fashions, when it comes to World War II from 1939 to 1945, they didn't pay attention to that notion. Not only did you have this wildly chaotic storm, this perfect storm of colonialism coming to a close, and all of a sudden the cessation of the war in May and August of 1945 causes the whole world to fall under communist influence and domination, being fought off in the West, not always successfully. It was a near-run thing, and it still isn't over. As a matter of fact, if one pays attention to the observations of some of the more recent historians, you will look back then and you'll say, well, maybe the West, and the U.S. in particular in this case, should have sat that out. Again, I mentioned Prof. CJ. His absolutely fabulous series on Woodrow Wilson shows why Woodrow Wilson, for the most part, can be assigned the moniker of Patient Zero for a lot of the ills from a warfare, military, and realignment perspective we have suffered throughout the entirety of the 20th century, and it's resonating now in the 21st century. In earlier podcasts, for those of you who are new to mine, you will discover I talked about regional conflict complexes. And what that is, it's the notion that, and we'll take the instantiation of World War II, for instance, when you had Poland and Yugoslavia and all of these places involved in this major conflict, all of a sudden it breathed oxygen into the embers of these long simmering regional and supranational conflicts that were occurring within those nation states themselves. And quite literally, through the happy coincidence of the decolonization movements that the West championed, and of course the ruins that the West, excepting the U.S., were in at the conclusion of World War II, led to so many wars and so many conflicts at a much smaller level, but nonetheless much more populous than in World War II, in which so many countries and so many people died. and were displaced. So what we have with Ferguson and Shapiro in that particular podcast, and I would urge you to take a listen to it yourself and see what you think, is you have folks who sort of got stuck on this notion that, well, how could one dare refer to Churchill as a villain? I don't think he was the villain. I think Darryl Cooper, as I mentioned, was either practicing hyperbole or had a grammatical misstep in that case, because knowing Cooper and knowing how thorough he is, and also he made the case that he has just started this World War II project that he is on presently. So maybe he hasn't read all the primary and secondary source documentation that would give him more subtlety in the way he teases out the permutations of what people said, what people did, and what actually happened. But nonetheless, the notion one takes away from the Ferguson Shapiro conversation is that how dare you criticize FDR? How dare you criticize Churchill? How dare you assign any realpolitik to the Russians, to the US, to the Germans, to the Japanese? Because we know that the Japanese and the Germans were, of course, evil. But of course, we know the West was not evil. And of course, by extension, the USSR was not evil, because they were fighting on the right side of history for the right side of history. So I just don't think that it was well thought out. I'm not surprised at it. I'm not surprised at the assaults on the non-credentialed historical community out there and the gatekeepers who wish to keep us out of their august chambers, echo chambers, mind you, and to make sure that our voices are minimized, eulogized, or even made light of because we don't have their credentials. But I'm here to tell you, speaking for myself, I've done a lot of the reading. Speaking for Prof. CJ, he's done a lot of the reading. And speaking for Darryl Cooper, I know through the grapevine, he does a hell of a lot of reading. And by the way, ask yourself, when it comes to being an historian, you're reading. You read for a living. That's what you do. You read, you analyze, you assess the evidence. It's not simply about dates and times. It's about cause and effect. And it's about those things that I discussed earlier as far as realizing how to be a sober historian, which I think to a certain extent, you don't have a lot of those left in the academic communities right now. So thanks for listening. The Institute thanks you for listening. I would urge you to go to the Libertarian Institute if you get the opportunity to give till it hurts, to support what we're doing and what our charter is and Scott Horton's good work there. Read my blog, which I blog at the Libertarian Institute 3 to 5 times a week about military fraud, incompetence, malevolence, and stupidity planet-wide, concentrating mostly on the U.S. and the West. So this concludes my first Libertarian Institute Chasing Ghost flash message by request from the Institute. So with that, I bid you adieu. I hope to communicate with you somehow, come over to the Institute and have a chat, have a read. Thanks for your support. This is Bill, out.